Chapter 2. The All-You-Can-Eat Buffet of Chronic Disease. In this chapter, you will learn vegetable oils promote a cellular chemical imbalance called oxidative stress. Oxidative stress can trigger inflammation and/or buildup of cellular debris and garbage. These processes are the underlying root cause of every known major disease. Our bodies normally prevent this imbalance with an army of antioxidant enzymes that are far more powerful than antioxidants in food. A diet full of vegetable oils makes oxidative stress and chronic disease inevitable. To explain the disease we now call epilepsy, ancient Greek physicians invoked a supernatural cause. The symptoms of uncontrollable shaking, frothing at the mouth, and bodily contortions appeared to be a punishment from the gods. Hippocrates, or perhaps one of his students, felt that this explanation could be improved upon, writing in the Hippocratic Corpus that epilepsy is no more divine or sacred than any other disease, but on the contrary, has specific characteristics and a definite cause. With that assertion, medicine emerged from the shadowy realm of the supernatural to become a science, a discipline rooted in provable realities. Suggesting that disease is a result of something we can understand may seem basic, but at the time it was revolutionary. The concept seems to me to be a first principle of medicine, a necessary foundation upon which subsequent physicians have since built the entire field. First principles are ideas that we can be absolutely sure are true. Physics is full of first principle ideas, from Isaac Newton's laws of motion to Euclid's elements. But medicine is underdeveloped this way. Health itself is expressed mainly as an absence of disease, which isn't very useful. In this chapter, I'd like to elaborate on a concept I think makes for a really good first principle too. Disease starts at the level of the cell. Your body is made up of cells, trillions of them. And all these cells must be in good working order for your organs to be in good working order. This idea is not entirely novel. It's actually part of medical education. The pathology textbook I bought in medical school begins by discussing cellular pathology right on page 1. Pathology means simply disease. Cellular pathology means cellular disease. The idea is also common sense. If you have healthy cells, you're going to be healthy. Likewise, if you have diseased cells, your organs will start to malfunction, and disease related to that dysfunction soon follows. In spite of this recognition that disease begins in the cell, medical science doesn't go much further with the concept. My medical education did a great job teaching me about how our amazingly intricate cells work and how they cooperate as organs. But after graduation, there is no opportunity to apply those ideas to actually heal our patients. It's as if allopathic medicine got to a point with its basic discoveries and hit a wall, never quite reaching the goal of fixing disease at the root. That barrier was built by vegetable oil. In this chapter, we're going to build on what we learned about oxidation in Chapter 1 by connecting the dots between oxidation and chronic disease. The gist of it is this. The toxins in seed oils promote a state of cell imbalance called oxidative stress. Over time, oxidative stresses deplete our bodies of antioxidants. Once that happens, our own cells can become a source of additional toxin formation. At that point, we start to develop inflammatory and degenerative diseases. Indeed, oxidation reactions might even explain one of life's deepest mysteries, death. A radical new theory. In 1949, Denham Harmon, a chemist for Shell Oil Company, started obsessing about death. He couldn't understand why we die. So at the age of 33 and with limited finances, he left job security behind and enrolled in medical school to better understand the human body. After graduation, Dr. Harmon took a part-time clinical position, which left him plenty of time to sit and ponder the aging process. As a chemist, he was accustomed to thinking about chemical reactions, and he was absolutely certain that the mystery surrounding death itself would come down to a simple cellular process that everyone was just overlooking. During an interview in 2003, he explained that he was on the verge of giving up. "I thought for 4 months in vain, and suddenly the idea came. Free radicals." Free radicals are destructive molecules that can damage our cells in much the same way that radiation can. Unlike radiation, they form as natural byproducts of reactions involving oxygen, collectively called oxidation reactions, like the oxidation reactions we explored in Chapter 1. The fact that free radicals can also damage our cellular infrastructure suggested to Dr. Harmon that they may very well be the thing that limits our natural lifespan. He carefully put his thoughts together and exposed them to the world in an article called Aging, a Theory Based on Free Radical and Radiation Chemistry, published 2 years later. This theory boldly proposed that our ultimate demise is brought about by oxygen, thanks to the accumulated damage done by those violent free radicals. The idea is that the free radical byproducts of oxidation reactions slowly destroy our cells one at a time until the tissues and organs depending on them can no longer function, and we succumb to infection or injury, develop cancer, or simply die in our sleep. In the final paragraphs of his article, Dr. Harmon makes the provocative suggestion that if this theory holds, then there may be a chemical means of prolonging effective life. He was referring to the idea of supplementation with antioxidants. Antioxidants were well known to science at the time for their capacity to stop oxidation reactions and prevent free radical damage from spreading within a cell. Oxidation was a new concept to medicine, a whole new mechanism of disease, different from viruses, bacteria, traumatic injuries, and other things most doctors were familiar with. It did more than just explain why we ultimately die. It also explained why our cells start to malfunction as we age, and why we develop degenerative diseases. Being a wholly new concept, the free radical theory was initially ridiculed. But it was rooted in solid science, and soon found plenty of supporters. Before long, this 3-page paper would launch an entire new branch of science called free radical biology. By the 1980s, free radicals had increasingly become part of basic medical research into cancer, cardiovascular disease, and strokes. The 1990s saw free radicals linked to Alzheimer's disease and over 100 other conditions. Dr. Harmon's fundamental ideas have since been accepted by most aging experts around the world, as well as by scientists looking for root causes of chronic degenerative diseases such as arthritis, emphysema, and heart and kidney failure, and by toxicologists studying the mechanisms of heavy metal toxicity and other agricultural and industrial pollutants. Dr. Harmon put oxidation reactions on the map, which is quite an accomplishment. Dr. Harmon was nominated 6 times for a Nobel Prize for his work in the field of gerontology, the field of medicine devoted to aging. His ideas now also inspire 21st century biohackers and practitioners of anti-aging medicine. All this stands as testimony to the power of chemistry to lead to major medical breakthroughs, as well as to the benefits of inviting chemists into health and nutrition conversations. In the decades since this big breakthrough idea, however, the chemical means of prolonging life have continually proven elusive. Dr. Harmon himself thought that with a healthy diet, regular exercise, and certain vitamins, particularly vitamins C and E, aging could be slowed by reducing the production of free radicals. He lived a productive life until the ripe old age of 98, having followed his own advice. But these simple measures do not work to delay the onset of any diseases or extend life beyond 120, as he'd hoped. In fact, his theory has fallen in and out of favor multiple times. Why the ups and downs? Over the decades, several generations of investigators have each proposed their set of compounds that might extend our lives, or at least stave off degenerative diseases. These scientists have tested antioxidant supplements, including vitamin C and E, phytochemicals such as resveratrol, from red wine grapes, algal antioxidants, like astaxanthin, related to vitamin A, NAD+, and other energy metabolites with antioxidant properties, and many more. New ones seem to pop up in the nutrition news every month or so. Other groups of scientists have tested genetic modifications that can make simple organisms like yeasts manufacture more of their own intrinsic antioxidant compounds, most famously compounds called sirtuins. Similarly, scientists have modified worms to produce more of the enzymes that trap free radicals, called antioxidant enzymes, to no effect. Still others have tested calorie restriction, because the process of burning calories generates a great many free radicals. In spite of the fact that calorie restriction could also cause malnutrition, this idea looked particularly promising for a while because it seemed to work in monkeys, which are much more similar to us than yeast. Unfortunately, it came out that calorie restriction studies were not actually restricting calories below the animal's needs. They were restricting the animals from eating as much as they wanted, which usually meant overeating and developing diabetes. In other words, these studies were just showing that overeating is unhealthy, something we already knew. With each new avenue of investigation, the theory has started to shine, only to be dashed when the investigators reached a dead end for one reason or another. But the idea that free radicals promote diseases that bring about cellular demise and ultimately our death makes sense. It's also rooted in solid principles of chemistry and cellular biology. So why isn't this field producing the expected results? What are they missing? They're looking at the problem backward. They're searching for antioxidants that can extend our natural lifespan. But the problem is we've been consuming more and more vegetable oils, and this depletes our bodies of antioxidants in ways that shorten our lifespan. This is not something mere supplementation can fully fix. How antioxidants protect our cells. In Chapter 1, we saw that vegetable oils are toxic because of their high PUFA content. However, before we go any further, I need to establish that we do need some PUFAs in our diets. We will revisit this and see how much in Chapter 3. All our essential fatty acids, both omega-6 and omega-3, are polyunsaturates, and we need them for the vitamin-like benefits I mentioned in the introduction. And as with vitamins, without enough of them, we can develop deficiency-related conditions, including dermatitis and digestive problems. If a mother doesn't have enough PUFA in her body while her fetus is developing, the baby's vision and intelligence can be limited. Just as every cell in our bodies needs vitamins to function properly, every cell in our bodies needs PUFA for normal function too. If you took biology in high school, you may remember that every cell is wrapped in a membrane called, logically enough, the cell membrane. What you may not remember is that our cell membranes are constructed with fat, including a good deal of PUFA. Between 30 and 40% of the fatty acids in our cell membranes are polyunsaturated. The rest is saturated and monounsaturated. The PUFA molecules in our cell membranes are chemically identical to the PUFA in vegetable oils, and in fact, the oils we eat are where much of the PUFA in our cells comes from. And just like PUFA in the fryer, oxygen attacks those double bonds with destructive effects. But unlike in the fryer, the destruction is kept in check. Our bodies protect membrane PUFA with an array of antioxidants, the first and foremost being vitamin E. Vitamin E is the first line of defense. It's the first to catch a free radical within the cell membrane. It efficiently blocks oxidation once it starts by taking a hit for the team. The team here being Team PUFA. To do its job, vitamin E nestles down amid a patch of PUFA molecules where it can trap free radicals and expel them from the area. Vitamin E works exactly like that twisted domino I described in Chapter 1 to divert the energy of free radicals away from the rest of the PUFA in our cell membranes. Vitamin E gets oxidized itself, taking one for the team, thus protecting its neighboring PUFAs from oxidation. But once vitamin E gets knocked over, it needs to be stood back up again, to extend the domino metaphor. And standing up, this domino requires a team approach. That's why supplementing with vitamin E can't make up for eating way too much PUFA. Let me show you what I mean. Antioxidants work in teams. Vitamin E is the most famous PUFA-protecting antioxidant. Protecting PUFA in our cell membranes and in the lipoproteins that carry cholesterol and other fats in our bloodstream. But vitamin E can't do the job on its own. Antioxidant molecules actually cooperate with each other, working in teams. Team PUFA also includes vitamin C and other compounds discussed later, including glutathione, sulfur, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide phosphate, or NADPH, and a number of others. Some members of the team must come from our diets, and our bodies must make some of them on their own. To explain this, I have to mix my game metaphors. The team works together to play a molecular game of hot potato, where the potato is a free radical. When vitamin E catches a free radical, it's been oxidized. The domino is knocked down. But it's just a temporary injury to the vitamin E molecule. The oxidation of E causes a kink to form in its tail, flipping the tail outward so that the free radical can't harm any more membrane PUFAs. Safely shifted out of the membrane, the vitamin E can now pass off its problematic free radical to the other members of the team. The first team member to step forward is the antioxidant vitamin C. Vitamin C takes the high-energy free radical from E, which fixes vitamin E. And its tail straightens out again and flips right back into the membrane where it started, ready to trap any more troublesome radicals. The domino has been stood up again. Now that vitamin C has the free radical, however, it needs to pass it off to another antioxidant compound. In this case, a sulfur-containing molecule called glutathione accepts the free radical. Sulfur gets oxidized during this exchange, and glutathione, in turn, passes its oxidation problem onto another compound called NADPH. Each time the various antioxidants pass the free radical along, the free radical's energy state drops a little bit. In this way, the antioxidant team permits the free radical to safely discharge its energy, and the hot potato essentially cools down. Our bodies support this complex chain of interactions with numerous antioxidant enzymes that play a role in repairing the damage done by free radicals. Each enzyme requires its own set of nutrients and has other requirements for production and operation. What does all of this have to do with vegetable oils? Vegetable oils promote vastly more free radical reactions than saturated and monounsaturated fats. And supplementing with a few vitamins is not likely to be enough to contain the problem. We know this in part thanks to an underappreciated human clinical trial that was used to determine our vitamin E requirements, called the Elgin Project. PUFA zaps our antioxidants. In the 1950s and 1960s, researchers at the Elgin State Hospital in Elgin, Illinois, and Chicago's University of Illinois College of Medicine carried out a series of studies on inpatients that tested the impact of PUFA consumption on our vitamin E levels. They knew that Americans were eating wildly different amounts of PUFA depending on whether they used animal fats or plant fats in their cooking. So they wanted to find out if eating more PUFA meant we needed more vitamin E. In short, the answer is yes, much more. Study participants ate either a low PUFA diet made with lard or a high PUFA diet made with corn oil. The corn oil diet contained about 30% polyunsaturated fatty acids by calories, comparable to today's average intake, while the lard diet contained just 4%, comparable to many pre-industrial diets. At first, the study confirmed that people eating corn oil do need more E to protect their cell membranes from oxidation than people eating lard, 3 times more. But after about 2 years on a high corn oil diet, something unexpected happened. Suddenly, people's blood levels of E started to drop, even though they were getting the same dose of E as they'd been taking all along. And their cell membranes started testing positive for signs of oxidation-related damage. This means that even higher doses of E were no longer enough to prevent corn oil-induced cellular damage. The fact that it took several years for this problem to occur suggests that after an extended period on a high PUFA diet, our bodies undergo an important shift. All that PUFA likely exceeded some critical threshold. After that tipping point, the used vitamin E, or alpha-cotoferol quinone, could no longer get refreshed by its antioxidant teammates, so levels of fresh vitamin E, or alpha-tocopherol, dropped. How did this happen? As the people assigned to the corn oil diet kept eating corn oil, their body fat changed. The scientists have been testing participants' body fat on a regular basis and discovered that after a few years of eating a high PUFA diet, their body fat filled up with PUFA. But this aspect of the experiment was almost completely lost to science. And so, the effects of long-term PUFA consumption on body fat have been almost completely overlooked, until more recent research brought the question back into the light. PUFA and body fat. Stéphane Guillenet, PhD, is a neuroscientist who studies eating behavior and who has paid attention to vegetable oil. In 2011, it had occurred to him that we've been eating more and more of it, and he wondered what it might be doing to our body fat. In 2015, after reviewing all the available studies reporting on the composition of human body fat from the past 50 years, he published a literature review article covering what he had discovered. Our body fat is stored under our skin in a layer that doctors call adipose tissue. The only way to know what kinds of fatty acids are in someone's body fat is to take a tissue biopsy. You can't get this information from a blood test. A biopsy involves pressing a tiny cookie-cutter-like instrument into someone's skin, removing the plug of skin and attached fat, packing the sample into dry ice, and rushing it off to a lab for analysis. This was also how the Elgin Project evaluated participants' PUFA. These studies get done for a variety of reasons, although not very often. Fortunately, between 1959 and 2008, there were 46 such studies, enough for Dr. Guillenet to gather meaningful information. The biopsy data showed that the portion of PUFA in human body fat had gradually increased from 9.1% of all fatty acids to 21.5% during the roughly 50-year span of time. During that same time, the amount of PUFA in the average American diet had also doubled, increasing from about 15 pounds per person per year to 30. When Dr. Guillenet plotted adipose PUFA against time on a graph, the neat and unusually linear arrangement of the 46 biopsy data points marching upward year after year, perfectly paralleling the increase in vegetable oil, prompted him to comment that someone might be suspicious of how I selected the studies. He had included every relevant study available in the English literature and admitted he was very surprised to see such a consistent trend. Surprising as it may have been, the lesson was clear. The more vegetable oil people ate, the more their body fat started to look like vegetable oil. Importantly, the process takes years. The Elgin Project scientists determined that the PUFA content of people's body fat slowly increased to match the PUFA content of their diets after about 5 years. Excessive PUFA in body fat makes excessive demands on the body's all-important antioxidants. The exact amount of PUFA that's too much will vary from person to person and even within individuals, depending on other elements of the diet. Today's average PUFA intake sits at historically high levels, while our consumption of antioxidant vitamins, minerals, and other necessary cofactors has not risen. Vitamin and mineral deficiencies run rampant within our population, with more than half of Americans over age 4 lacking adequate potassium, magnesium, choline, and vitamins E and K. Even if we were getting vastly more of all the required nutrients, that doesn't guarantee that our bodies could keep up. It may not be genetically possible. This high load of PUFA in our adipose tissue causes a fundamental shift in our body chemistry once that tipping point is reached. The process underlying that shift is called oxidative stress. Oxidative stress, when you become like the deep fryer. In 2017, a brilliant German chemist named Gerhard Spitaler, who had been investigating the dangers of turning away from stable animal fats and using vegetable oils, died at the age of 85, having gained little recognition for decades of dedicated work. During the last 40 years of his life, he'd published nearly 100 articles on the link between polyunsaturates and diseases related to oxidation and free radical formation. Both free radicals and oxidation reactions can tear through our cell membranes to cause this dangerous state of cellular imbalance. Likewise, oxidative stress can promote free radical formation and oxidation reactions. Oxidation and free radicals are so intimately linked that the free radical theory of aging has at times in its evolution been called the oxidative stress theory of aging. Oxidative stress causes free radicals to form, and free radicals can also promote oxidative stress. Think of free radicals as flying embers that can start fires, and oxidative stress as giant fires that spew hot embers. Dr. Spitaler may not be a household name, but he is an absolute giant in the field of biochemistry. In the 1950s, he had invented an antibiotic called sulfadimethoxine, a precursor to one of the most widely used antibiotics today, Bactrim. So he had already saved billions of lives. In the 1980s, he discovered an antioxidant component of fish oil called furan fatty acid, which appears to be at least as responsible for the benefits of dietary fish as omega-3. Then, in the early 1990s, he started warning the world about the dangers of replacing saturated fats with vegetable oils. Or at least, he tried to. As a chemist, he was making his argument using chemistry, but the dizzying array of chemical equations in his papers would be meaningless to most people. So his efforts to communicate were not as successful as they should have been, given their importance and potential to positively impact our lives. Dr. Spitaler's publications show that the very same reactions that occur in deep fryers can also take place inside our cells. This takes us back to the domino effect. Remember, PUFAs have more double bonds than saturated or monounsaturated fats, making PUFAs more susceptible to oxygen attacks and free radical chain reactions that have a kind of molecular domino effect. Dr. Spitaler determined that if oxygen initiates a single free radical spark within our membranes, the damage can spread like wildfire or a row of toppling dominoes, just as it does in heated vegetable oils. In other words, oxidative stress can literally fry our biology from the inside out. In his articles, he laid out page after page of chemical equations, mostly stick diagrams of polyunsaturated fatty acid molecules and how they changed and became distorted after interacting with oxygen and free radicals in living tissues. The equations are circular, full of arrows that curve back from the end of one reaction right to where the reaction had started. This is how chemists express the idea of a chain reaction, that domino effect we've been talking about. Dr. Spitteler was trying to tell us that our own cell membranes can deteriorate into toxic compounds, and that those compounds can turn right around and attack more PUFAs, in a loop statement of cellular destruction. Whenever oxygen kicks off one of these chain reaction domino effects within a cell membrane, that cell is experiencing oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is a state of cellular imbalance that disrupts everything the cell is trying to do. It unleashes mutagenic, cytotoxic, carcinogenic toxins and free radicals that can damage proteins and DNA. During episodes of oxidative stress, all semblance of organization is lost. Free radicals fly everywhere, shattering enzymes, mutating genes, and penetrating membranes where they will create more lipid oxidation products. If all this sounds abstract, think of oxidative stress inside your cell as a teeny tiny version of the biblical disaster Bill Murray and the Ghostbusters described as rivers and seas boiling, human sacrifice, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria. And it's no joke. It's a kind of toxic chaos that portends potential Armageddon for a cell. Dr. Spitteler wanted to warn us that oxidative stress is contributing to numerous diseases. This is exactly what the free radical biologists have been saying since the 1950s. But there's a big difference between their message on oxidative stress and his. They jumped right to trying to prevent it, throwing antioxidants at the problem before fully understanding it. Dr. Spitteler did the work to understand the source of the free radicals, which is the root of the problem. He literally drew the chemical equations showing the connections between oxidized PUFA molecules, free radicals, and the molecules that investigators have found in people suffering from inflammatory and degenerative disease, where they are known as the biomarkers of oxidative stress. Things like malondialdehyde, nitrotyrosine, and many more. This is why preventing free radicals and oxidation reactions with antioxidants has proven futile. It's also why preventing both by avoiding toxic vegetable oils should be a slam dunk. Antioxidant supplements are mostly worthless. The world has woken up to the harms of oxidative stress. Thousands of companies selling antioxidant supplements claim to be able to prevent inflammation and related degeneration. Some of the most popular of these supplements include resveratrol, lycopene, zeaxanthin, and megadoses of vitamins. Unfortunately, or fortunately, if you look at it from the point of view of saving money by not buying worthless products, these products are more likely to harm than hurt you. Most of the antioxidant compounds you can buy are made by plants for plants and serve no function in our bodies. It would be like giving a firefighter a bunch of fruits and vegetables and telling him to go fight fires. It just doesn't help. And if he's carrying a fukushu kumquat when he needs a fire hose, that's going to get him into trouble. Worse, most of these antioxidants can promote oxidation under certain circumstances. So in that case, it would be like giving our firefighter a flamethrower. Rather than taking antioxidant supplements or megadoses of vitamins, I recommend supporting your body's firefighting crew with basic tools, mineral supplements, as well as a simple multivitamin. It's important not to overdo the dose, because too much of even these nutrients can provoke oxidation. For more on supplements to support your antioxidant enzymes, see the supplementary PDF. Dr. Spitteler devoted his last decades to laying out the evidence that PUFA oxidation contributes to one health problem after another. It is involved in the plaque formation that promotes heart attacks and strokes. the oxidized protein plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease, and the inflammation that drives autoimmune disease, diabetes, cancer, and more. He was describing a universal mechanism of pathology that is known to be responsible for myriad diseases, but in a way that no one seemed to notice. It's heartbreaking. It's one of the consequences of silos in science, and it has prevented doctors from understanding patients' pain and suffering. It's particularly heartbreaking because all of us do learn in medical school that oxidative stress promotes inflammation. We just don't learn that vegetable oils are the main reason why our patients experience oxidative stress. Linking oxidative stress to inflammation. Oxidative stress starts small and often goes undetected, but we can actually feel some forms of oxidative stress as it spreads. Oxidative stress is intimately linked to the body's inflammatory response, and inflammation causes many symptoms, including pain, warmth, congestion, and swelling. Inflammation can make us uncomfortable, but in some ways, it's necessary for daily life. Inflammation clots your blood so you don't bleed to death from a paper cut. When you have a cold, inflammation is what gives you a runny, stuffy nose. Inflammation also readies the immune system for battle against infections. After a joint injury, such as an ankle sprain, inflammation helps break down the frayed ends of your damaged ligaments to clear the way for rebuilding and repair. The pain keeps you from walking until your tissues can be rebuilt and made strong again. The redness, swelling, itching, and pain you experience after a mosquito bite or a bee sting are examples of inflammation. These are all functions of the body's acute inflammatory response, which is how the body responds to trauma and infections. So we need inflammation, and we need oxidative stress to get it going. All inflammatory responses in our bodies start with oxidation of the polyunsaturated fatty acids in our cell membranes. The body's inflammatory response system works like this. Infection or trauma damages cell membranes. The cell membrane damage activates special enzymes that oxidize the PUFAs in those membranes, triggering a cascade of additional reactions that magnify a tiny distress signal into something really loud. We've seen that PUFA oxidation happens so fast that chemists call it a chain reaction. Our bodies take advantage of the speed of this process, which enables the inflammatory reaction to spread quickly and contain the problem. Without membrane PUFA oxidation, there can be no inflammation and no defense against infection or trauma. In other words, PUFA oxidation is designed by nature to trigger a life-saving inflammatory response system. But the system can get tipped out of balance. If we experience oxidative stress too often, we experience inflammation too often. This is one of the most important and most harmful consequences of high PUFA body fat. In contrast to acute inflammation, which is helpful, chronic inflammation is a problem. Chronic inflammation can make us feel chronically unwell, or even confuse the immune system and cause autoimmune diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, or Graves, celiac, and Crohn's diseases. Inflammation is quite the buzzword today, and for good reason. Many of us are living with the consequences of chronic inflammation. If our diets constantly promote PUFA oxidation, we can deplete our bodies of antioxidants. This is what the Elgin Project showed. A diet high in vegetable oils will eventually deplete the body of antioxidants, tipping the system out of balance and promoting inflammatory disease. These days, inflammatory diseases keep doctors in business. Most of our chronic diseases are inflammatory conditions. Some, such as gout and scarlet fever, an autoimmune disease related to strep throat, were linked to inflammation centuries ago. More recently, we've discovered that out-of-control inflammation contributes to all autoimmune diseases, including celiac, Crohn's, thyroiditis, and rheumatoid arthritis. In 1986, A research paper listed over 100 conditions that had already been linked to oxidative stress-induced inflammation. It has been implicated in heart disease, insulin resistance, and diabetes. More on those in the next chapter. More recently, we've added chronic pain syndromes and long COVID. The menu of inflammatory conditions a doctor learns to diagnose represents a virtual all-you-can-eat buffet of chronic disease. The inflammation involved in these conditions can be direct and noticeable immediately, or indirect and noticeable only later. Gastritis is an example of the former, and celiac of the latter. Either way, once inflammation starts, our bodies will continue to experience it until the PUFA oxidation completely stops. But as we know, PUFA oxidation is a chain reaction. That means once it starts, everything happens blazingly fast, and all it takes is one little spark left unquenched before it flares up all over again. Fully quenching each inflammatory fire requires an arsenal of antioxidant equipment. With so many PUFAs in our diets and in our body fat, we can run out of firefighting equipment. The number and diversity of diseases associated with inflammation has attracted a lot of research attention. But there is still one gigantic piece of the puzzle missing. Nobody can explain why oxidative stress and inflammation have become such a problem recently, particularly over the past 30 or 40 years. That missing link is driving billions of dollars worth of medical research every year. I have yet to see any of the medical scientists doing the research for inflammatory diseases suggest that the missing link could be vegetable oil, with one important exception, discussed in the following The Omega Imbalance Theory of Inflammation. But it's one of those ideas that won't go away, because it's solidly rooted in the basic sciences of chemistry and cell biology. One simple explanation can make the link without the need to spend another research dollar. On a vegetable oil diet, inflammation takes so long to quiet down that people's symptoms continue or worsen long after the initial infection or injury has resolved. Does fish oil reduce inflammation? In the 1990s, Artemis Simopoulos, a scientist with the National Institutes of Health, proposed that the root cause of our modern epidemic of inflammatory disease might be related to an aspect of vegetable oil that I haven't talked about much here. There are two types of PUFAs in vegetable oils, called omega-6 and omega-3. In response to infection or trauma, enzymes in our cells transform these two kinds of fatty acids into different sets of chemicals with complementary effects. Omega-6 fatty acids tend to promote inflammation, and omega-3s tend to shut it down. It's likely that in our evolutionary past, our dietary ratio of these two was closely balanced, maybe 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. Today, it's more like 1-to-10 or 1-to-20 in favor of the pro-inflammatory omega-6. Since vegetable oils contain much more omega-6 than omega-3, Dr. Simopoulos thought this might be why so many people were suffering from inflammatory diseases. In the late 1990s, before anyone had an opportunity to test the idea in experiments, a journalist proposed writing a book called The Omega Diet. The book encouraged people to balance their omega-6 by supplementing with omega-3, and it was wildly popular. Unfortunately, the book ignored the role of oxidative stress. Since then, scientists have tested the imbalance theory in human clinical experiments and have shown that even a very imbalanced 19-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 does not increase the body's inflammatory responses, at least under normal circumstances. Still, it could, in theory, worsen symptoms during extreme stresses, such as when someone is experiencing serious infections or trauma. In such circumstances, having way more omega-6 than omega-3 could very well promote blood clotting, excessive swelling, and a few other serious problems. But even if vegetable oils were balanced in omega-3 and omega-6, they would still deteriorate into toxins during cooking, and we would still suffer from excessive oxidative stress and inflammation. This is why fish oil and other omega-3 supplements don't often help. In fact, they often just add fuel to the fire. That's why, after decades of trying to prevent asthma attacks, heart attacks, cancer, and other diseases with fish oil, the results are consistently unimpressive. Fish oil may be helpful for rheumatoid arthritis and chronic dry eye, but not much else. Avoiding seed oils will work for everything, and it'll work even better. Inflammatory diseases catch our attention. But oxidative stress doesn't always trip off the inflammatory process in a way that's dramatic enough to trigger symptoms. It can also cause a slow-acting, silent form of cellular damage that can take many years for doctors to identify as a medical problem. A kind of gunk can start building up in our cells to the point that they can no longer function. I believe this is how vegetable oil promotes many of the diseases of aging that we call degenerative diseases. The garbage catastrophe, a theory of aging and disease. One drizzly day in the spring of 1906, a German pathologist named Alois Alzheimer peered into a microscope to examine tiny samples of a woman's brain at his hospital in Munich. He discovered a peculiar substance filling many of the cells. The woman was a 50-year-old who had recently died after years of worsening memory, increasing disorientation, and hallucinations. He called these formations senile plaque, as they were usually seen in much older people. Soon, other pathologists around the world noticed the same tiny blobs in people prematurely affected with dementia. They began calling them Alzheimer's plaques. While the dreaded dementing disease is now all too familiar, the origin of the peculiar substance eluded scientific explanation for nearly 100 years. Finally, in 2000, researchers settled on their answer: oxidative stress. The cellular garbage forms because oxidation damages bits and pieces of cellular protein in ways that the cell's garbage disposal systems can't clean up. So the oxidized gunk just accumulates within the cell until it forms amyloid plaques big enough to show up under a microscope. Researchers were confused for so long because amyloid doesn't just result from oxidative stress. It also causes oxidative stress, a common theme we've encountered before. So scientists were stuck in a chicken-or-egg loop statement, unsure if the plaques came first and caused the disease, or the disease developed first and caused the plaques. With the root cause question settled, they were able to explain another mystery of Alzheimer's. Why don't anti-inflammatory therapies help? They soon recognized that these plaques trigger little to no inflammation because the affected brain cells slow down their metabolic activity, seemingly in a desperate attempt to control oxidative stress by going into a kind of cellular hibernation. This adaptation, unfortunately, slows down the brain's processing speed, and that's when symptoms usually begin. Over time, brain cells shrink or die. The brain atrophies, and those who are affected slowly lose themselves as they succumb to dementia. Many degenerative disorders follow a similar progression. If you follow sports news, you may have heard about tau protein, the marker of traumatic brain injury found in football players who've suffered repeated concussions and severe personality changes. Tau protein is another form of oxidized cellular gunk. Another common disease-related blob is oxidized alpha-synuclein, which causes Parkinson's disease, and another form of dementia called Lewy body dementia, the second most common dementia after Alzheimer's. Lewy body dementia is harder to diagnose, starts earlier, often as attention deficits, and progresses faster. An example outside the nervous system is drusen, blobs that build up in the eye and that can cause a form of blindness known as macular degeneration. Another common garbage blob is lipofuscin. This dark pigment is responsible for age spots on the skin and is associated with all the previously mentioned disorders of the nervous system, although it's unclear if it plays an active role. It's also found in people with certain forms of kidney disease, some people with high blood pressure, and with a painful bowel disease called Brown bowel syndrome. Chemically, the various oxidized garbage blobs behave like the black, sticky, tar-like gunk on the bottom of an oven that resists easy cleaning. But unlike us, when we clean our ovens, our cells can't use solvents to clear away the buildup. They simply have to live with it. They try to cope by wrapping the sticky, dark material in a protective membrane, or by scooching the tiny garbage blobs out of the way, so they're unlikely to harm anything else. Over time, however, more and more of them pile up. The diseases related to this sort of debris all develop more or less in proportion to the size of the pileups. Interestingly enough, not everyone with this sort of material in their tissues develops disease, which probably has to do with their genetics. Genes versus diet. Genetics is much less powerful than diet when it comes to determining our susceptibility to disease, which makes me glad I didn't stick it out in Cornell's molecular biology PhD program. Genetics does determine how well your body fights off oxidative stress in various tissue compartments, such as brain versus liver or bone marrow. This means that your genes mostly determine which diseases you'll likely get by following an oxidative stress-inducing diet. Whether you get the disease or not comes down to what you eat. If the modern diet is an all-you-can-eat buffet of chronic disease, then your genetics tell you what's most likely to end up on your plate. Scientists encounter oxidized cellular garbage associated with age-related diseases so often that in 2001, a Swedish pathologist who studies lysosomes, the cell's garbage disposal units, coined a phrase for it, the garbage catastrophe. He published a paper on the subject called Garbage Catastrophe Theory of Aging, Imperfect Removal of Oxidative Damage. He explained that since these damaging accumulations are a result of oxidative stress, then perhaps by manipulating our cellular ability to withstand oxidative stress, future technologies might prevent aging and age-related diseases. Of course, he wouldn't have known that our modern diet powerfully promotes oxidative stress. If he did, he might have considered that preventing oxidative stress by avoiding vegetable oils might be a more practical strategy. Bottom line, the fact is that the normal aging process itself is driven by oxygen and by oxidation reactions. Because PUFA accelerates oxidation reactions, high PUFA vegetable oils accelerate the aging process. Cutting vegetable oil slows it down. With oxidative stress currently linked to so many conditions, it would seem logical that doctors would be equipped to identify and treat it. Unfortunately, that is not yet the case. Doctors are taught that a Western-style diet contributes to these degenerative diseases, which is true. But the devil is in the details. And we learn that the two most harmful elements in a Western diet are saturated fats and cholesterol. More on this in part two. We hear this over and over again, in spite of the lack of direct scientific evidence that these two nutrients can promote diseases related to oxidative stress. There is, however, direct experimental evidence that polyunsaturated fats play a causative role in a wide variety of human diseases, but it's not built into a doctor's training. Just to give you one example, let's take a look at the tau deposits of Alzheimer's disease. When scientists tried to create tau during animal experiments, They find that saturated fats do not readily promote tau deposits, and cholesterol actually inhibits tau formation. But polyunsaturated fats are a different story. PUFAs are the most effective inducers of tau protein assembly, initiating its formation 7 times more powerfully than monounsaturated fats and 50 times more powerfully than saturated fats. As a result of our miseducation on root causes, doctors spend a lot of time focusing on risk factors that we don't truly understand. What your risk factors really mean. When you go to the doctor for a physical exam, he or she will screen you for risk factors that might indicate you're likely to develop a serious disease that might be preventable with medications. But this universal practice has little or no net benefit. Risk factors are not root causes, and in treating our patients' risk factors with drugs while ignoring the real root causes, we are doing more harm than good. The risk factors we most commonly screen for include smoking, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, family history of diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes, and cholesterol. Other risk factors that not every doctor will test for include abnormal uric acid, homocysteine, lipoprotein A or LPA, and high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, HS-CRP, a sign of certain subtypes of immune system-mediated inflammation. And there are actually many more. All of these risk factors put our patients at higher risk of heart attacks. These same dozen or so risk factors also indicate higher risk for many other diseases, including Alzheimer's, strokes, several cancers, heart failure, liver disease, and a huge array of other degenerative and chronic conditions. Quite a coincidence that so many different diseases can be associated with the exact same list of risk factors, isn't it? It's not actually a mysterious coincidence, of course. The simple, logical explanation is that most of the risk factors themselves have the same root cause, oxidative stress. But although medical journals inform physicians that these diseases are associated with oxidative stress, it's presented as yet another risk factor. It's not yet clear to medical science that oxidative stress is the one root cause we should all be paying attention to, much less that we need to stop eating vegetable oils in order to control it. As a result, we can't help people very much. Worse, many doctors believe that the drugs we use for managing some of these risk factors are fixing the problem at its root, but the risk factors are not causing the disease. By using drugs to manage the outward signs of oxidative stress, but failing to fix the underlying problem, we allow the oxidative stress to continue unchecked, while also exposing people to side effects of drugs. As evidence that modifying these risk factors does little or nothing for anyone, I submit the story of homocysteine. If you have too much homocysteine in your blood, your diet might be low in one or more B vitamins. In the 1990s, research showed that people with higher homocysteine levels had a higher rate of heart attacks, strokes, and cognitive decline. So doctors started ordering this test and treating high homocysteine with vitamins, which successfully lowered homocysteine levels. We thought we'd solve the problem, until further research showed that this did nothing to prevent heart attacks, strokes, or cognitive decline. This has been dubbed the homocysteine paradox. But it's hardly a paradox. It's simply that the underlying problem behind high homocysteine is oxidative stress. And the fact that vitamin supplementation improves homocysteine levels, but not the more meaningful problem, actual disease, is further evidence for the need to address the root cause of oxidative stress. The homocysteine story has implications for all of our other so-called risk factors. If we can improve a risk factor without reducing disease, then what are we really accomplishing? Over the years I've been in practice, I've seen time and again that risk factor management often fails to produce the expected outcomes. Yet we continue to manage these same risk factors the same way, burying our heads in the sand. I see this as a direct outgrowth of our ignorance about vegetable oils. Now that we've learned about oxidative stress, we can understand another insidious way that a diet full of vegetable oils harms us at the cellular level. I've come to understand that these oils can contribute to diseases that we now attribute to lack of willpower, unpleasant personality traits, and random chance. In the next chapter, I want to show you the link between vegetable oil and the biggest challenge that medical science is facing, but that our training doesn't prepare us to treat. It has to do with how cells generate energy. Oxidative stress is not only driving chronic inflammatory and age-related diseases, it's also driving the obesity and diabetes epidemics by changing our cravings and our relationship with food.